Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the author of Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. Our guest, Sarah Carr, who's an education journalist, highlights three schools represented by a popular African-American principal, a Harvard-educated Teach for America teacher at one of the schools, and a young African-American student who wants a better education than she is getting. This story, it comes from New Orleans, where, as you'll recall, after Hurricane Katrina hit that city and devastated so many schools and homes and everything, there was a move to really change the whole school system. So now almost every taxpayer-funded school is a privately run charter school. So this book takes on so many different issues, charter schools, public education. But I think it's best to give you what Sarah says about this, which is what the book is all about. New Orleans offers a test case, she writes, on an unprecedented scale of how this vision plays out, charter school vision, of what works, what does not work, and for whom. The debate over urban education in America, crystallized in New Orleans, speaks to broad, deeply rooted tensions in our country over what the civil rights movement should look like in the 21st century and who should lead it. Let me tell you a little bit about Sarah. She has written about education for 12 years now. She's written about school vouchers, efforts to educate China's massive population of migrant children. She worked as a staff writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She also was at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and we're delighted to have her with us to talk about all of these issues. May I give you our phone number? Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Sarah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm really excited to be here today. It's a treat.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I've heard so many wonderful things about you from actually people who used to work with you at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is nice.
I lived in Wisconsin for 5 years up until 2007, and I'm actually headed back to Wisconsin next week, so it'll be nice for me to reconnect with some people in the education and journalism communities there.
Yes, and we'll give information to our audience about her appearances, one in Milwaukee and one in Madison. Please just give us a little overview of what happened, Sarah, after Hurricane Katrina hit in New Orleans and how it specifically affected the school system, which I understand experienced a radical change.
Sure. There were two major actions that were taken in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The first was that the state swept almost all of the public schools into what's known as the Recovery School District, and state officials had the intent of chartering the schools as quickly as possible. And so over the next few years, they turned the schools that they'd put in the Recovery School District over to charter operators. So now 80% of the public schools in the city are charters, which is the highest percentage of any city. And the other major shift was that they fired all of the employees in the wake of Katrina. And so that was obviously a very, very controversial move that's still going through litigation now, but which has sort of allowed for kind of a major change in who's leading and teaching the schools. In New Orleans, there has not been collective bargaining in place since Katrina, and so employees are pretty much at will as they are in the business sector. And, you know, I've spent time in charter schools where a principal has decided that a teacher isn't cutting it and has literally been able to fire them the next day. And so that's another very controversial shift where it sort of really depends on kind of your vantage point on these issues, whether or not that's good or bad overall.
You start the book, a meeting that took place in a funeral home. It's a story that you tell prominently. You put it at the beginning of the book. But you also say that it stayed with you in the months that followed as you wrote Hope Against Hope. What happened in that funeral home?
The meeting in the funeral home was a debate over the future of a specific New Orleans school called Craig, and there was a proposal to turn Craig over to a charter school operator. And so that meeting was basically about essentially, on the surface at least, it was about sort of whether or not that this particular charter school operator should take over the school. But there were two sort of African-American leaders who came out that night who just sort of presented very sort of contrasting visions for the future of the school. And I thought it really kind of spoke to this broader tension over whether sort of school and community reform needs to be driven by a community or can and should be imposed on the outside, because there are a lot of folks in New Orleans who sort of view the charter movement as being largely something that's been imposed from the outside. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the rhetoric and the debate that night really spoke directly to those issues.
And there were valid concerns. A lot of this has been imposed, including the makeup of some of the teachers. I mean, you have a whole different teaching staff when you rely on Teach for America and kids coming from Harvard and all of these places. It was, what a change, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really has been a change. And I mean, before Katrina, the teaching force was about 70 to 75% African American, and that was one of the highest percentages in the country. And about half of the teachers are still African American across the city schools, but you see every year you see sort of a little bit of a shift where it becomes a little bit whiter overall. Mm-hmm. And that just raises big and important issues about sort of whether or not these teachers kind of understand the social and cultural context that their kids are coming from well enough and have the experience and the ability to develop the relationships necessary to do this kind of work.
You had the hurricane that leveled a lot of schools and leveled a lot of people's lives, but was part of the motivation for doing this wholesale change, radical change, the fact that public schools in New Orleans simply weren't performing very well?
That's certainly a big part of it. I mean, by the numbers, they were performing pretty abysmally, and that the significant majority were sort of not meeting sort of a basic threshold on state standardized tests. And something like between 5% and 10% were actually continuing on to graduate from college after exiting the public school system. I mean, and there are people who are critical of the reforms who argue that sort of a lot of those who pushed them through sort of ignored what pockets and elements of success there was and ignored the fact that the system was, even though it was at a very low level, was moving in a better direction after Katrina. But there's no question that overall it was a highly low-performing school system, and I think sort of the debate was more about why. Was it starved of resources and not given the tools that the teachers and kids needed to succeed, or on the other hand, was there just something sort of structurally unsound about it so that it needed to be completely blown up? That's, I think, where the debate is.
And who decided that it needed to be completely blown up? Who made the decision?
It was sort of a confluence of people and factors. The state superintendent at the time, who is now deceased, and a former state board of education member, who's from New Orleans, were very, very key behind the scenes in pushing this through. And then, I mean, they had a lot of support, obviously, from former President Bush at the federal level, who was very supportive of charter schools and privatization and voucher schools. And so I think it was the key people were at the state level, but they definitely operated with support from the federal government and to some degree from sort of some of the nation's largest foundations that are pushing sort of a school reform agenda.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to that funeral home for a moment. And as you know, you covered a voucher debate and voucher expansion here in the city of Milwaukee, which has been important nationally, and one of the first school districts to do this. You talk about this public battle and I think we've seen this play out in Milwaukee, too, between two African-American gentlemen, one supporting vouchers, one very concerned about it. Let's talk about how this plays into issues of race and why it is that we have seen this kind of battle in the minority community about whether or not this is going to be beneficial and will open up doors that have been open to white people for a long time, and that's, you know, voucher schools or charter schools or private schools, whether or not that's good for the minority community or not. What did those gentlemen have to say? And I'm sure that resonated with you as you did this book.
Yes. I mean, I think that you raise an important point because it's really crucial not to see sort of any community or class or racial group as a monolith on this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times sort of the debate over charters or vouchers or school reform more generally is painted sort of as a black versus white. But there's a lot of sort of tensions within the black community. And there are those, you know, in New Orleans, for instance, in the black community who sort of feel like school reform is this white corporate imposed agenda. And there are others who really view it as kind of a valid way to try and lift kids out of poverty. So it's impossible to generalize. And that was something that I saw both in Milwaukee and also in New Orleans.
Let's talk about the people that you followed most closely, and let's start, please, with Gerald Lynn Stewart, the 14-year-old girl who is important because she was going through the schools here. Who she was, what her strengths were, and what educational experience she had as she changed the way she was educated.
Mm-hmm. Gerald Lynn was about 9 when Katrina hit, and when she came back to the city with her parents after Katrina, she was starting middle school, and her family kind of came across a KIPP charter school operator, which, for those who aren't familiar with KIPP, it's sort of a very, very, very highly structured charter. Some people would argue that it's sort of great and does a great job preparing kids for college, and other people would sort of describe it as overly structured and militaristic. And so Gerald Lynn started middle school at a KIPP school, which was among the first charters to open in New Orleans after Katrina. And her parents really embraced it right away and sort of loved the structure and the discipline of it. Gerald Lynn all along has had much more mixed feelings. But she ended up pretty happy with her middle school experience. And then when I started following her, she was starting high school, and she was about to enroll in the first KIPP high school to open in New Orleans. And there was still this kind of debate between her and her parents about whether or not she had to continue on with KIPP. And there were times when she would say she wanted to go to quote unquote a normal school. But the KIPP high school that I ended up following for that first year that Geraldine was enrolled at struggled quite deeply in its first year. And really, really had a lot of enormous challenges. And I think kind of illustrated that in the charter school movement, in a lot of ways, it's just as varied as traditional schools. And even sort of at this charter network that overall is performing relatively well, there are still some schools that are struggling.
And how do we know it's performing relatively well? What are we looking at to measure?
I mean, I'm talking about test scores. I mean, when you're looking at KIPP, there's a huge, huge amount of debate, just sort of anecdotally and also looking at the research body about whether or not they're enrolling the same type of student who's coming in at the same level as traditional schools, or whether or not they're sort of expelling students at higher rates or have lower student retention rates. And like the debate about vouchers, I find a lot of the research body, those who are sort of supportive of networks like KIPP, come out with research that makes it look pretty positive, and those who are more skeptical into it. It's a lot of the same sort of issues cropped up in my reporting in New Orleans with just sort of a dearth in a lot of cases of unbiased research data.
Right. I hear what you're saying completely. It's interesting you said that her mother and her family thought this was going to be great for her. They were very excited about this. She had reservations. Where is everybody now on excitement?
You know, about the same place. I mean, she definitely about the same place. She's in the middle of her junior year of high school now, and she still is at that same high school. I think that the her family is still really hopeful that she'll go on to college, and I think she is too, and she's doing pretty well in terms of her grades. I think that the struggles that particular KIPP school that I followed had in its first year might have made her parents a little bit more skeptical. There was sort of one point in which they came pretty close to kind of bowing to her demands to transfer her to another school, but in the end they decided to stick with it, and that it would be better to see it through rather than kind of both kind of bouncing her to another school that might not potentially sort of be doing that much better overall.
Let's go to one of the teachers, and first let's get some historical reference here. How many of the teachers who were in public schools before Katrina are still teaching in charter schools?
That's a good question. And, you know, I don't know if anybody actually has solid data on that point. The teaching force right after Katrina, I mean, it was something like, you know, 6,000 or so teachers before, and then when the schools reopened, it was just much, much smaller the first full year. It was someplace between 1 and 2,000. And a lot of those who were part of the initial reopening of schools were rehires from the old system. And then some additional ones have been rehired over time. So my guess is, if I had to guess, I'd say maybe at least half of the teachers across the system are from the pre-Katrina schools, but not much more than half.
Mm-hmm. So you center on one who comes from outside New Orleans, who is a Teach for America gentleman, young guy, Aiden, He's got a pretty rough time. But I'm interested in Teach for America and where this other half is coming from. Are there a lot of Teach for America teachers in New Orleans charter schools now?
There are. It's an interesting question because there are sort of broadly kind of two different types of charter schools in New Orleans. There are ones that are run by veteran educators from the pre-Katrina schools and that tend to hire predominantly veteran educators.
Mm-hmm.
But the increasing sort of majority of them are run by somewhat younger school leaders who came to Katrina at some point in the last decade and who sort of fit with this much more kind of KIPP-like model of charter school and often hire a large number of either Teach for America core members or sort of recent alums of the programs. And so there's a significant number of schools where the principal is maybe between the age of 28 and 35, and the teachers are predominantly between the ages of 23 and 27.
Why? Why have they done that?
I think partly it's just kind of people hiring from their own network. And I think also sort of a lot of these charter schools are very, very kind of rigorous places to work at in that, you know, Aiden Kelly, the teacher who I followed when he first started at that particular charter school called Psy Academy, he was clocking 80-hour work weeks, and there's an expectation that you'll be accessible to your students by phone from until 9 p.m., and he would spend 20 to 25 hours a week on lesson planning. And so they're sort of built around this very kind of grueling staffing model, which raises sort of a lot of long-term sustainability issues, and I just don't think that is going to appeal to a 55 or a 45-year-old or maybe even a 35-year-old in a lot of cases in the way it would to a 25-year-old who's sort of full of energy and less likely to have a family of their own.
Right. And what about the pay, the difference in pay between a veteran educator pre-Katrina and Aiden post-Katrina?
Since it's a completely kind of ununionized system, the charters at least, the charters are able to sort of pay whatever they want to pay. And so they might develop sort of a very different pay scale that doesn't focus on experience at all. Most of them do to some degree reward experience in their pay structure. Overall, salaries have actually gone up considerably on average since Katrina, although arguably benefits have not, just because I think the benefits package that's available to a lot of the teachers at the charter school is probably not as good as the pre-Katrina benefits package. Mm-hmm. But it really is kind of like a business model where principals set their own pay scales and structures.
But Aiden decided that he didn't want to teach after a period of time. Why?
He, in his case, it was like a promotion. He taught for 4 years, and then his low point was actually, in the course I was following him in the middle of his first year at the school, Psy Academy, when he felt like he was kind of running and just not sort of accomplishing what he wanted to and was always overwhelmed. But I think he did sort of reach a much more sort of stable and happy spot as a teacher, and then ended up making a decision to leave the classroom to become the director of curriculum and instruction at his charter school.
And tell me about the differences between this charter school and the KIPP charter school. Was it the same kind of heavily structured, high expectations, uniforms, et cetera?
Yes, yes. In fact, the Psy Academy was actually much more structured than the first year KIPP school. I mean, it's one where they have very, very detailed uniform requirements and where the young new students sort of walk a straight line down a hallway to follow a piece of tape, and just where sort of every kind of, they have something called sparking that sort of details how they're supposed to be sort of sitting up and responding in class. You know, the S in spark refers to sit up straight and so forth. And that kind of intense structure is also sort of highly debated and controversial. The school operator argues that it helps sort of create a calm environment where kids really, really feel safe and can focus on learning. But there are others who question sort of why is this model just being applied predominantly on sort of low-income Black communities, and sort of are we preparing them for kind of a prison-like structure environment? So there's a lot of debate in New Orleans and elsewhere about that particular educational approach.
We have yet to talk about Mary Laurie, who is also one of the people featured in the book, a veteran of the pre-Katrina system, who keeps her school open late to keep kids off the street, and we'll hear her story as well. And we need to take phone calls, and I'll take those right away. Sarah Carr is our guest. As you can tell just from our conversation so far, there are many levels to this book, the change from a public school system to a charter school system in New Orleans, how it works for students, how it's been working for teachers, why such a change, the debate that takes place among people who believe that this is a chance for young people to grow and to use a business model that will be much more efficient and inspirational and structured, so that there will be better results for teachers and for students particularly, and those who have some very deep concerns about charter and voucher. And so Sarah spent a long period of time looking at many of these schools. The book is Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. We do want to tell you, I got my right paper here. Sarah said she'll be in Milwaukee. She wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for 5 years as well. She's going to be in Milwaukee at Boswell Books on next Tuesday at 7 o'clock. So it's a chance for Milwaukee educators and people interested in charter schools and everybody who should be interested in schools and education to meet her and talk with her. She's also going to be in Madison on March 18th, which is Monday at 7 o'clock, and this is at Union South. She will be part of a panel discussion. Well, it will be, I guess it's a panel if it's two people. Barbara Miner, who joined us about a month ago, author of Lessons from the Heartland, will also be speaking. So, to your phone calls, and to the story of Mary Laurie as well. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take just a couple phone calls before we get to the story, and an important story it is, of Mary Laurie. Our first caller is Marty from Palmyra. Hi, Marty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Some friends of ours, their daughter volunteered for Teach for America. She went down to New Orleans. And I have to preface this with the fact that she aced her ACT test. Yeah. 6-point grade average, very, very intelligent girl. Her problem was she had no city in her. She got into these classrooms, and it was 8-year-olds, and if she blinked, they were fighting with each other, rolling joints. They stole her cell phone when she had her back to them. And one of the mothers called her up a couple days later and said she found a cell phone in her son's backpack or whatever, and return it to her. The point I want to make with this Teach for America thing is, the onus was placed upon her. It was her fault for not controlling the class. Parents would come in, they would blame her, and the constituents behind Teach for America would side with the parent and fault her for her inability to maintain control of the class. She had to sign a 1 or 2 year contract, and she wanted to get out of it because she was going home and crying every single night. And the impression was given is, oh, you break out of your contract, it's not going to look good on your record in the future.
Oh.
And it was very, very disconcerting for her, and that's an understatement.
Sarah.
Yeah, I think one of the issues, as I said, there are these two very different staffing models in New Orleans, and that there needs to be more schools with sort of a mixture of kind of young, maybe Teach for America teachers, but a core base of veteran educators who know how to handle a classroom, who know the kids, and who can really be supportive to the young people. I think it's the schools that that rely all on 22-year-olds in Teach for America that are really, really struggling, and in a lot of cases putting kids in situations like the one that you describe. And that's not only good for the young teacher, but it's also really not fair to the children, because if they sort of are able to engage in that kind of behavior, they're not going to be learning. And so I do wish moving forward that there was more of an emphasis on creating staff that blended experience with youthful enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Marty, for your call. Karen in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi, I just, maybe ironically, I'm just returning to Oshkosh from a charter school conference in Appleton, the Wisconsin Innovative Schools Network. And I wanted to make sure that everybody understands the difference between charter schools, voucher schools, and in Wisconsin, there are two kinds of charter schools. The vast majority of charter schools in Wisconsin are chartered by school districts. And so I wanted to make sure that people who are listening are not saying, oh my gosh, we've got a charter school in our district. It must be whatever they're thinking about what you're talking about in New Orleans. That Wisconsin charter schools and New Orleans charter schools are very, very different.
You're familiar with both of them. Sarah, would you like to comment?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a fair point. I mean, voucher schools are sort of purely private schools that receive some state funding, but charter schools are a little bit more of this hybrid, and sort of how exactly the hybrid balances out can be different depending on what state you're in. And in Milwaukee, there were some charter schools that were part of the district that employed unionized teachers, and there were others that weren't. In New Orleans and Louisiana, it's the latter model in that the teachers are not unionized, and even though there are some that are part of the district, most of them are very, very autonomous, so I would argue it sort of goes in the direction much more of private management in New Orleans and Louisiana.
Would it be fair to say that these are for-profit models, places like KIPP?
No, I mean, not. I mean, there's a lot of debate sort of about what exactly for-profit means in this context. In kind of a literal sense, most of the charter operators in New Orleans are not for-profit. In fact, I think there's just one for-profit operator left in New Orleans. The ones that have been for-profit have really pretty much all tanked and not done well,
really?
At least in New Orleans. I mean, there are some people who argue it's kind of a fuzzy line because not thinking of any charter operator specifically, but some of the not-for-profits pay such high salaries that there are charter critics who say really they kind of are functioning as de facto for-profits, even though they don't have sort of, even though they have nonprofit tax status. But in New Orleans, the ones that are literally defined as for-profits have been few in number and have done really poorly.
We need to get to the story, and I didn't mean to neglect her, of Mary Laurie, who was a veteran of the pre-Katrina system, administrator of O. Perry Walker High School.
Yes, Mary Laurie was the third main character who I followed, and she was pretty much, she moved to New Orleans when she was a very young child, and so she grew up in the New Orleans schools and then sort of worked her way up through the system. And she ended up the principal of a charter school after Katrina, and it was one of the first charter schools to open after the flood. And she really, I mean, it was sort of the first caller's point in that sort of schools are kind of left to deal with all of these issues. And I mean, her case sort of exemplifies sort of this school working as hard as it can to take a holistic approach to education and sort of meeting kids where they're at in a city with sort of a very high rate of gun violence and sort of a lot of instability in kids' lives. But I think overall her approach and philosophy surrounding education is somewhat different than the Psi Academy school or the KIPP school, and is sort of much more rooted in kind of these traditional community-based models.
And I'm wondering, when you look at all these schools that you covered, there has been some criticism about charter school and a basic philosophy, difference in philosophy, one being open the doors and come on in, no matter who you are, no matter what your disability is. How do these charter schools deal with students who have special needs, whatever form that may take?
That's a great question, and I've actually done a lot of reporting on that. And overall, particularly when I first moved to New Orleans in 2007, the percentage of students with special needs is significantly smaller than the charter schools, in the charter schools than the non-charters. That gap has been narrowing, but not as fast as it really should be, particularly when it comes to students with severe disabilities. And so that has been a question moving forward that's vital in New Orleans, just as you move to an almost all charter system, just to make sure kids with the biggest challenges, whether or not they have a diagnosed special need or not, are finding good homes and spots in the schools. And I think that the charters run the gamut. There are some that really do want to serve all kids and really have had open doors, and there are others that have not. And so it's not fair to generalize. I mean, there was one charter school in one of my early years of reporting where I was sitting in the main office, and I heard an administrator tell the parent of a student with special needs, you know, we only take kids with certain disabilities here. And I don't want to make that story sound indicative of all the charters, because there are lots where that would not happen ever, but there are definitely cases with charters sort of playing fast and loose with the rules and not serving the variety of students that they should.
Well, who's overseeing all of that? Isn't it the responsibility of the state of Louisiana to make sure that schools are open to all?
There has been some progress in this regard, in that they've instituted kind of a much more common application process, which addresses some of these equity issues, just because schools can't really, most schools in the city, there are still some that do, but most can't get away with sort of having their own kind of creative application processes. But if it's all centralized, it's a little bit easier to detect sort of possible abuses in schools that aren't open indoors. But I think that that's sort of more abstractly, that's been a big issue in that overall, I think there should have been more aggressive oversight of this area earlier. And there could have been some sort of system in place, maybe like an ombudsman, sort of a centralized person to go to when that wasn't sort of connected with anybody who had a vested interest or a conflict of interest. So for, you know, for a parent of a student with special needs who feels like their child was turned away or rejected to go to. And I think that there needed to be more aggressive and early efforts made on this regard that weren't.
And is it right, Sarah, that outside, is it correct to say the city of New Orleans, if you go to areas that tend to be predominantly white, there's more of a public school setup?
Yes. I mean, charters are spreading throughout the rest of the state, but definitely they're growing fast in the urban areas like New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Shreveport. But there is some growth also in sort of more rural, predominantly white communities. But that's sort of been kind of another, I guess, underlying tension is sort of, you know, why did you, I mean, granted that New Orleans was a particularly low-performing system pre-Katrina, but it definitely, I think, in sort of a racial sense, seemed like it was sort of targeting this predominantly black community, saying, you know, you can't run your own schools. And so that's sort of what's led to a lot of the ongoing tensions about self-determination and whether a community should be able to decide the course of its own educational system.
Exactly. Let me ask you, if you had a child, if you were living in New Orleans and you were living in the city and committed to living in the city, how would you navigate the school system? Would you feel comfortable in doing that?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. And the thing is, like, I have sort of more of a leg up than anybody. You just said I've spent time immersed in the schools for years. And I guess it's saying something that even with that, you know, even sort of knowing about kind of the data and the players and having been in these different school environments and kind of having a firsthand sense of which ones have sort of good school cultures and relationships and which ones don't. I mean, I would still really struggle, I think, in a lot of ways. And so I think you see kind of, you see middle-income, well-educated parents struggling, and so that, what does that mean for a parent who kind of is working 80 hours a week and doesn't have sort of connections and doesn't have a car, so they can't be driving to open houses?
Right.
And it's a really daunting thing, and I think that sort of that information gap is a huge one, and that in cities like New Orleans and like Milwaukee, where there's a lot of choices, there needs to be a huge and concerted effort to make sure you're reaching the most vulnerable families and really empowering them to try and access the schools that they think are best for their kids.
What is Mary Laurie, with age and with experience in a system comes some degree of wisdom, and she strikes me as the kind of person who is caring, I mean, really caring, and that what she had to say about all of this might be particularly important. So what did she say?
You know, I think Mary Laurie had very kind of mixed feelings about this. I mean, I sort of feel like in her, and I don't want to speak for her too much, but I sort of feel like in her mind it wasn't so much kind of a charter versus non-charter thing. She was just very much more kind of focused on the humanistic issues rather than the political ones. And so she wasn't sort of like engaging in battles about whether or not sort of charter schools overall are good or bad, or whether or not Teach for America is good or bad. She was sort of like, how do we make what we have right now work for our kids? And that's just not just her. I found that really kind of the political and ideological battles kind of were not what the teachers and frontline educators and parents were engaged in or cared about. But that's what so much of kind of the public rhetoric and discourse is focused on.
More phone calls for Sarah in a moment. Sarah Carr is our guest this hour. She is author of Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. Sarah worked for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for some 5 years, and of course is familiar then, so She's a double the guest with Milwaukee's educational issues. She spent a long period of time covering particularly three different schools and three different people, one a student at one of the charter schools, one a teacher, brand new teacher, and one a veteran pre-Katrina principal. And they're all dealing with charter schools now because that's what's happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where all the employees of the public schools were fired. And she says that at least half are now part of the new system. But that's, you know, a big change. And it's a big change because they are charter schools now, so worthy of her careful eye and her pen. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Sarah's going to be in Milwaukee and Madison. We'll give you those dates again as we proceed. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome more phone calls. Let's go to Sherry in Appleton. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I'm a retired teacher. I taught in the public schools for 34 years, and I have to admit I was skeptical of both Teach for America and charter schools. My daughter was in Teach for America, and with very little training was sent to a very challenging special ed classroom in the Milwaukee Public Schools. She did get through the year, and in Teach for America's defense, once they realized what Megan was up against and when some of the other Teach for America teachers were up against, they reanalyzed and looked at putting these young teachers in some of these challenging classrooms, and I think they have a different stance on that. I also, though, wanted to give out kudos to Milwaukee College Prep, which is a charter school in Milwaukee where my daughter now teaches. And it sounds very similar to the schools your expert is talking about, the author is talking about in New Orleans, where there's a very young administration and a young staff. And recently, my daughter said some radio reporters, ESPN reporters, were at the school. I'm not sure why, but she said at the end of the day, these big guys literally had tears running down their face because they were so touched at what's going on in this school and the difference it's making in needy children's lives.
Thank you very much for the call, Sherry. Sarah.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear that your daughter ended up having a positive experience. And I mean, in the course of covering the schools in New Orleans, I've seen some Teach for America teachers just do serious harm not only to their students but also to themselves. But others have just thrived and really excelled and are still working in the schools. And I think a lot of it does boil down to that question of support and whether or not they have support, whether or not it's from TFA or from the school that they're working in. But overall, it's not fair to the kids in particular, but also to the teachers to put them in contexts where they don't have significant support.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about one of the fundamental changes that you were witnessing and that we're all witnessing with the growth in these kinds of schools. And I wonder how significant it is and what exactly it means. Historically, you write, most Americans have viewed schools as reflections of the communities they serve. Psi Academy and several of the other new charter schools in New Orleans represent a fundamental shift of this paradigm. Their leaders hope the families absorb the school's values. Instead of the community sort of running the philosophy here, it's exactly the opposite. That's a big change, Sarah.
Yes, it is. And I mean, it is a big shift. I want to sort of add the caveat that, you know, even sort of when you have kind of a democratically elected school board, oftentimes the turnout is so low in those races, particularly among low-income parents, that I don't know if there's any sort of model that I've seen where I feel like low-income parents' voices and perspectives are empowered in the way that they should be. But that said, I mean, I think that the biggest thing is in the schools that I focused on in New Orleans is this college-going ethos. Like, so many of them are kind of college. And I think sort of two slight concerns about that. One, I mean, there just needs to be sort of a broader array of programs in cities like New Orleans. I mean, I think it's great to try and encourage more kids to go to college, but there's so many high-paying jobs now for those with technical skills, and there really aren't those kind of programs that are doing that sort of training in New Orleans right now. And I also think that they really, parents need to be bought into this college-going mission, because if they aren't, it's fundamentally not going to succeed in the long run if they view it as something that's sort of taking their kids away from them or changing them into somebody else. And so I think some of the schools that I spend time in are great about having those kind of conversations, and others really aren't, to their peril.
Yeah. Thanks, Sherry, for the call. Annalisa is next in Green Bay. Hi, Annalisa.
Hi. This has been very interesting. I'm really interested in this issue, and I just need to say that whenever we have these discussions about schools and bad schools and this and that, nobody ever talks about the impact of poverty, and are we as a society going to do anything about it? Because to me, that is one of the chief components of this problem, and I don't disagree that schools can always improve, and that there are many things we can learn to help kids learn better. But these families are existing from day to day and struggle so. And that makes it so very difficult for these kids to learn. And so that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you, Annalisa.
I think that's a key thing, and that's actually one of the main takeaways from my book, is that just making changes in the schools alone is not enough, that the approach to poverty alleviation needs to be much broader and holistic, and that you can't sort of have a broken criminal justice system and a broken healthcare system and all these broken infrastructure serving families and expect the schools alone to really succeed in the long term.
Yeah. Or have a mom, you know, who has to go to work at the crack of dawn, and you're getting up, you're in middle school, and you got to get your uniform on and get to school by yourself. I mean, there's a good chance you may think of, well, I don't really need to go today. Nobody's going to know, right?
Yeah. No, and there's a lot of, like, really kind of wonderful parents who I spend time with for this book who just, they have to do that. They have to work 80 to 90-hour work weeks to make ends meet, and so they're just not able to spend the amount of time with their children that they really want to. So even though these kids are part of kind of very wonderful, supportive families, they're kind of left on their own a lot more than would be ideal.
Yeah. Thank you, Annalisa. You bring up a very important area. Sarah is next in Zion. Hi.
Hi there. I remember recently on another WPR program on education, there was a guest who was talking about how mentoring was, just like Sarah is talking about right now, about how mentoring is the way to turn a problem school around, and that to make sure teachers are successful. And this woman pointed to I'm pretty sure it was a school in New Orleans that was like a great example of a school that had gone from failing to just all the students are doing really well now. Well, I mean, you know, relatively. And am I right? Was there a school in New Orleans that was like a great example of that?
You know, there are a couple that you could be thinking of, and I think that that's a key issue, is that sort of the more support that schools have through programs like mentoring, the lot easier it is going to be for them to do this kind of work, and for kids to be seeing role models who come from the same place as they do, who've gone on to be really successful. That's really powerful. I'm not sure specifically what school that they were thinking of, but there are a couple I think of that I know of that have built strong mentoring programs.
And thank you very much for the call. Sarah, thank you for being with us. Your book is getting rave reviews and beautifully written, and we'll give information about when you're going to be in Wisconsin, which is next week, right?
Yep. Starting next Monday. Thanks so much for having me on. I've had a great time.
Good. Yeah, we did too. Thank you. Sarah Carr, and she's going to be at Boswell Book on Downer Avenue on Tuesday, March 19th at 7:00. And then she will be in Madison on Monday at 7 o'clock, and this will be at the Union South, Politics of School Choice in New Orleans and Milwaukee. She will be at a panel discussion with Barbara Miner, author of Lessons from a Heartland, which is a book that we've talked about with Barbara a little while ago. All right, so that's it. We'll be with you Monday, All Things Political at 9 o'clock. And we will be talking about hunger in America. Joy Cardine will spend an hour of her show talking about it, and I will be spending an hour of my show talking about an extremely important issue in America. We'll speak with the authors of a documentary film about food and how everybody ought to be able to have enough to eat. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody.